And welcome back to Monday's broadcast of Making Sense. Joining me next in the broadcast from San Francisco is Michael Hinkson, National Ambassador of the Braille Literacy Campaign and a miraculous survivor of 9/11, and the author of Thunder Dog, A True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. Well, Michael, tell me first about the Braille Literacy Campaign and your work as a National Ambassador for them.
A lot of people think today in the world that blind people don't need Braille anymore. Braille is the primary language that we use for reading and writing. It's like the print alphabet in every sense of the word. It's a true alternative to print. And people think we don't need it because, oh, well, there's so much stuff available through audio. Your computer can talk to you. You don't need Braille for that. We don't need to teach Braille to children, and we certainly don't need to teach it to adults anymore. And the response of many of us is that's certainly not true. My response specifically is, look, if that's the case, then let's stop teaching kids who can see to read print. I mean, you've got television, you've got all this other stuff. The reality is Braille is the only means that we have for reading and writing. Both of those are important in any education. And in the case of blind people, whether you're a child or you are an adult who has become blind, and that doesn't mean losing all of your eyesight, but that means losing enough of it that you don't read well.
Right.
You really can take advantage of Braille. And it may be harder, but learning any language is sometimes a challenge.
Sure.
Braille is important. The literacy rate has dropped from 50% to 10% over the past 30 or 40 years, and
really?
That's just deplorable.
Wow. That's a huge drop.
It is, but educators, for example, don't emphasize it. It's even with children who have some eyesight, who are encouraged to use very large print books or use magnifiers that will allow them to magnify print and read it at 10 or 15 words a minute, the response of a lot of teachers is, well, they get to read print while somebody who's totally blind has to read Braille. These educators, most educators in the country, have not really caught on and understand what being blind is all about. And the fact is, Braille is extremely important to any child who loses enough eyesight that they have to use alternative techniques to be able to function.
And is the literacy campaign working out?
It is. We're slowly seeing change. Several years ago, back in, I think, 2009, the government printed a coin, the Louis Braille coin, celebrating the 200th anniversary of Louis Braille. It actually is the first coin in the country that had Braille on it. And some of those are still available for sale from the National Federation of the Blind. You can go to www.nfb.org. But it's all about teaching Braille. I learned Braille. I started in kindergarten. I learned Braille and used it through school and college and as I was getting a master's degree in physics. And I still use it today for many things that I do. My job today is as a volunteer, I am the ambassador, but for money, I'm a public speaker. I literally travel the world talking about trust and teamwork, talking about our experiences on 9/11, and talking about God's involvement in that, but just trying to help people recognize that when we do have changes in our lives, we may not be able to control the fact that the change happens, but we certainly can control how we deal with the change, and that's kind of what it's all about. And Thunder Dog is really a book that talks about that. It's not a 9/11 book at all by any means, although 9/11 is the central part of it because I worked in the World Trade Center on 9/11. But the story isn't how I got out, but the story is really how I got there and a little bit about what happened in getting out and then life after that.
You were blind from birth, right?
I was blind basically from birth, I was born prematurely and given too much oxygen, so that damaged the retinas.
Okay. And that's something that was common back then? You said you were born in 1950.
It was fairly common. Medical science has started to discover that giving a child a completely pure oxygen diet when they're born prematurely was not good, but it still wasn't accepted by all of medical science. And so as a result, a lot of doctors didn't subscribe to the theory of give a child some regular air and then mostly oxygen, which would have made all the difference in the world. Nowadays, there are still some children who get pure oxygen because there's no choice, and they risk blindness, but that's the lesser risk of not being here at all.
Okay, you mentioned that you ended up on the 78th floor of the World Trade Center on 9/11, September 11th, 2001.
Correct.
Yet you say the real story, as you mentioned just a moment ago, isn't how you got out of the World Trade Center, it's how you got in there in the first place. What do you mean by that?
When I was born, and it was discovered that I was blind, my parents were told to put me in a home, to send me away because blind people couldn't amount to anything. Blindness is one of the top five fears in our world, according to the Gallup polling organization. Sure. It's feared over any other disability by a factor of 3 to 1. Mm. People think that if you're blind, you can't do anything. That is just the way it is, and that's so wrong. Eyesight is not the only game in town. In fact, you people who have eyesight have your own disability. You're light dependent. You know, we fixed that. Thomas Edison in the 1800s made it possible for light-dependent people to be able to function in the dark by inventing the electric light bulb.
Right.
So technology helps all of you. Well, why is it that we can't assume that technology can assist other people and that we don't lose our wits simply because we lose our eyesight? And the answer is it's mainly because we teach people that blindness is a horrible, the grossest, horrible thing that ever happened in the world, and it's not. So I grew up believing, because my parents rejected what the doctors told them, I grew up believing that I could do whatever I chose to do. And so as a result, I went to college. I got a master's degree in physics. I was offered a position after that, before I went off and looked at getting a PhD and doing other things. I was offered a position that allowed me to go off and help develop the first device that literally took a picture of a printed page and read it out loud. And my job was to travel all over the country to allow blind people to use this device so that we could help the manufacturer, Ray Kurzweil, develop the first machine and the first production model of the Kurzweil reading machine that people could buy, which also led to the first optical character recognition system that anyone could use to do work where they would need to take print and convert it to something. I did that for the National Federation of the Blind, and then I was hired by Kurzweil. It ended up going into sales. Again, traveling the country, helping to sell not the machine for the blind, but the higher-end or more expensive commercial Kurzweil data entry machine. And since then, I've worked at a number of other companies that eventually led me to being hired and living in New Jersey and working in the World Trade Center for Quantum Corporation to run its Mid-Atlantic Region sales office, which I did. And that's where I was on 9/11. So the story is really about the challenges I faced, the challenges that people mostly created rather than just the fact that I had no eyesight, but the challenges and the barriers that people put in the way and the barriers that had to be overcome and which eventually led to being there. And then, of course, there was the story of getting out, working with other people, helping other people, working with my guide dog, Roselle, and getting out of the tower and then being across the street from Tower 2 when it collapsed.
Okay. When the building was first hit, you were inside of it, and it swayed back and forth. As far as I understand, the building moved like 20 feet in that swaying motion. Any idea what was going through your mind and what you thought may have happened at that point?
Had no idea what happened. I was in my office with a colleague who was in for some seminars we were going to be conducting that day, and David Frank and I were in the office speculating what was going on. Was it an explosion? It certainly didn't seem like it. Why is the building swaying? The buildings are made to move in a windstorm or whatever. They're actually big springs. So if you imagine a spring fastened to a table and then you push the top of it, you can kind of imagine what it might have been like inside inside the tower. But we speculated and had no clue. It could have been anything. And then, of course, later we learned what really happened. The airplane hit 18 floors above us on the other side of the building, so no one near where I was had any clue what had happened and what we were going through. But when the building became vertical, I met my guide dog, Roselle, who was coming out from under my desk. I was standing in the doorway and chose to do that because I grew up in Southern California where we had earthquakes, and even though this clearly wasn't an earthquake, building moves, go to door. That's how I grew up, so I did. And then I met Roselle. David saw fire above us. We got our guests to the stairs, and then after they started down, we swept the office one more time, and then David, Roselle, and I, in turn, left the office and went to the stairs.
Yeah, you went down,
started down.
Descending the stairs, it was quite a few stairs, almost 1,500 stairs, and a lot of chaos at the moment, I would think. How did all that work out?
People really worked well to get down. We worked together to make sure that there was no panic, and there were a few times that it got pretty close to it. and we talk about and tell the story in Thunder Dog about how we all got out and how we worked together to make sure that we all got out safely and that we all worked together to make that happen, how we met the firefighters and the first responders coming up the stairs. And really, it's a story that talks about what you can do when you have a challenge.
Right. And was the stairwell, was it filled with smoke, and was it hard for seeing people to see and so forth?
No, there wasn't smoke, because the fire was above us, but there were the fumes from burning jet fuel, and we did smell them.
Yeah.
They were stronger and weaker at different points on the stairs because there was airflow up the stairs, but that odor was constantly with us, and it took a couple of floors going down to figure out that we were smelling the fumes from jet fuel.
Yeah.
And from that, we assumed that we were hit by an airplane, but we really didn't know.
So
I didn't find out, in fact, what really happened until after both buildings had collapsed and I got my wife on the phone. I called her before we left the towers,
yeah.
But at that point, nobody knew.
Descending the almost 1,500 steps, how long did that take? Any idea?
We got to the stairs about 8:50, 10 to 9 in the morning, and we got outside into the sunlight. I checked my watch at 9:45. So it took quite a while. It took about 20 minutes to go down the first 48 floors, and then it took about another 23, 24 minutes to get down the last 30 floors because it got more crowded. Firefighters were on the stairs and so on, so people moved slower.
In that time that you were descending, did the other tower get struck by the other plane?
Yes, it was struck about 9:04, but we had no clue. We didn't feel it. We had no idea that anything had happened, and nobody was passing information up the stairs. And I can understand that the intent at that point was that it was important to get people out, not to do anything that would cause people to panic.
Yeah.
Personally, I like information, and I would rather have known.
No,
but by the same token, you know, I wasn't in control of the information. You deal with what you have.
Would you describe it then as an orderly descent?
I would describe it as an orderly descent. I think it was very tense, but people worked together, and I would say it was orderly.
Tell us a little bit about your guide dog, Roselle.
When I got Roselle, I had asked for a dog that would be able to focus. She was my fifth guide dog. I asked for a guide dog that would focus when work was required, but could play also, and Roselle was the perfect choice. She had a great on and off switch that she knew how to control, and when it came time to play, she was as good as the rest of them, but when it was time to work, no matter what the circumstances, she focused, and she did exactly that. So as we were going down the stairs, she did a great job. Of course, I kept praising her and saying that she was doing a good job, because that was what I needed to do to encourage her and make her feel that I was okay, so that she would be able to focus and not worry about me. In turn, monitoring what she did, she never acted nervous going down the stairs, which told me that she wasn't detecting anything that would cause her to be afraid,
right,
and cause her to be nervous. So the two of us fed off each other, worked together, which is what a team should do, and that's exactly what we did. And I talk about teamwork a lot when I speak, and what a good team ought to be, so that we can help people better understand teamwork. I'm amazed at the number of companies and people who form teams, but they don't really look at the we as much as they should. It's more the I, and that's just not the way it should work in a team environment.
My guest this afternoon is Michael Hinkson, and he's the author of the book Thunder Dog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. The book is published by Thomas Nelson. What does the title Thunder Dog mean?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about what to call the book, and the people at Thomas Nelson actually suggested it. Roselle was afraid of thunder. In fact, that morning at about 12:30, we had a thunderstorm. And, of course, there were all the thunderous sounds that happened on 9/11, some we heard and some we didn't. But, in fact, Roselle focused and did exactly what she was supposed to do. She knew that what was going on when Tower 2 was collapsing, for example, was not thunder, even though there was a very loud series of sounds when it first started. I describe it in the book as kind of a combination of a freight train and a waterfall. But Roselle just focused and did everything that she needed to do. And they suggested Thunder Dog. We were looking at some other titles, but Thunder Dog grew on all of us, and so that was what we eventually chose.
What were some of the other titles?
Well, I wanted to use Forward.
Forward.
And because that's the first and most important command that guide dogs are given. It's all about forward, and then you're to go in a straight line and continue to walk until you can't or until you're told to go a different way. See, what people also need to understand is that a guide dog isn't what most people think. A guide dog doesn't know where I want to go or how to get there, and I don't want the dog to know that. Yeah. The guide dog's job is to make sure that we walk safe and to follow my directions. So I need to tell the dog when to go left and right and to go wherever I want it to go. The dog's job is to alert me to anything that might be blocking our path by stopping, or she might just walk around it and continue walking until I tell her to go left, right, or she gets to a curb and we have to stop and wait to cross the street. And then, again, dogs don't do traffic lights. They're colorblind, and it's not the dog's job to know when to cross. I'll tell the dog to go forward because the traffic is going the same way I want to go. But, on the other hand, when we're crossing the street, if the dog sees that a car is coming across when they're not supposed to, or if I didn't hear a hybrid or silent car, the dog certainly can move us out of the way, and my job is to follow the dog. It's a team. It's what you do with your eyes and your brain, so I have to use a dog, or I'll use a white cane, but I choose to use a guide dog, and the guide dog will do its best to keep us both safe. So the team works together to survive.
And that's your element of trust.
It is absolutely all about trust on both sides.
Sure.
She trusts me as much as I trust her.
Mentioning the word forward, I see the forward is written by Larry King. What did he have to say?
Larry interviewed me first on September 14th, and I was on Larry's show a total of five times. Mm-hmm. I asked him in 2005, 2006, when we were thinking about writing the book, if he would be willing to write the foreword, and then when we finally got to the point of writing it, I contacted him again. He said, absolutely, I remember, I want to write it, and he did. And, you know, he called it a page-turner, for example. He wrote a great foreword to it.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it is a book that most anyone can read. It's a book that talks about life lessons, but at the same time, it's a book that talks about what we did and why we did it. And I think it's a book that can be inspiring for anyone who chooses to read it. It's been a New York Times bestseller and will be again. But, you know, it was a fun book to write, and I think it's an easy book to read.
When the South Tower came down, you were on the street. What was going through your mind, and how did you escape all that debris and all the chaos?
We were about 100 yards away from Tower 2 when it collapsed, and everyone just turned and ran for their lives. In fact, David and I were together. He turned and ran, and then I and Roselle turned and ran. No one was helping anyone except Roselle, and I continued to work. But I remember as we started to run, the first thing I thought was, God, I can't believe that you got us out of a building just to have it fall on us. As soon as that came into my mind, I remember that immediately I heard a voice in my head, as clear as you're hearing me and your listeners hear us, that said, don't worry about the things that you can't control. Focus on running with Roselle, and the rest will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. And I just had this absolute certainty that if we worked together, we would be okay. And I followed that. I followed that advice, and I know that that was God talking to me. We ran. We turned a corner. We ended up catching up to David. We all continued to run. We got caught in the dust cloud of the fine particles of Tower 2.
Right.
We started looking for a way to get inside the building that we were running next to just to get out of the debris. Suddenly there was an opening that I heard on the right, and Roselle obviously saw it. I told her to turn right. She turned right. She took a step, and she stopped.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, in all of that panic, Roselle stopping, I knew, just because she had been behaving as she was supposed to, she must have stopped for a reason. And well, it turns out she had. We were at the top of a flight of stairs. So when I discovered that, I told her to go forward. We went down into the stairwell. We found ourselves in the New York subway system, and we were there for a while until a police officer came and told us and others to leave.
Hmm. What'd you do next?
We got outside. We walked. We've discovered that Tower 2 had indeed collapsed, which just was a total shock.
Yeah.
We continued going west, as it were, on Fulton Street for about 10 minutes, and then we heard that freight train waterfall sound again, and we knew that it was our tower, Tower 1, collapsing.
Oh.
We made sure that we were out of the way of another dust cloud that was coming at us, although we were far enough away that we thought we wouldn't be hit by flying debris.
Yeah.
After the dust cloud passed us and things calmed down, we discovered that Tower 1 indeed had fallen. I then tried to call my wife again, I tried to call her after we got outside from Tower 1 in the first place and couldn't get through because the circuits were busy. But this time, both towers had gone down. I was able to get through, and she's the one who told us that it was all about a terrorist attack.
How did she respond to what had happened to you when she found out what had taken place?
Well, she, when we first talked and then she turned on the television, at first, of course, no one knew, and then Tower 2 was struck. She didn't know what was happening with me, of course. She got up and she said, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but people know that Mike worked in the World Trade Center and they'll probably come over. So she got up and just kind of did some of the normal things that she might do. And then when Tower 2 collapsed, she kind of thought, well, I don't know if he's coming home, but I better be ready in case people come. And she actually was washing clothes and just kind of straightening up the house a little bit for something to do.
Yeah.
Also with the idea that if I came back, I came back, and if I didn't, you know, then she'd be able to deal with people. Friends started coming over. Our friend Tom Painter, who Karen had known since high school, who was also living in New Jersey, came down not knowing whether I was alive or not. And I don't know exactly when he got to the house. Of course, then Tower 1 collapsed, and it was shortly after that that I called her, and we both talked and kind of exchanged, shed tears together, and then she told us what had happened. But she knew at that point that I at least was out.
When you think back to that day, 9/11, what are some things you think about initially?
I remember the first responders who passed us on the stairs and who we interacted with. I remember also the incredible number of stories of people who should have been there who for one reason or another were not. A woman who set her alarm clock for 7 o'clock to get up, the alarm didn't ring on time because she accidentally, and had never done this before, set it for 7 p.m. instead of 7 a.m.
Right.
Other stories of people who were supposed to be in the tower and for one reason got diverted. One person who worked at Cantor Fitzgerald, who had just been terminated and got down to the street rather than staying to talk more and survived. The head of Cantor Fitzgerald, of course, the investment firm where we lost so many people that day, who wasn't in the building because that morning there was a viewing for one of his employees, a vice president, who had been killed in a helicopter crash the month before.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember those, but I certainly mostly remember the first responders bravely going up the stairs to deal with whatever they had to deal with and our interactions with them. David, Frank, and us going down the stairs and things that both of us were able to do, and he especially was able to do as we went down the stairs. You know, those are all things that stick with me. But most of all, I remember that we all had a choice as to how we deal with the change after 9/11. And I think Billy Graham put it best at the service, the National Prayer Service on September 14th, that God doesn't do bad things. And following on that, I would say God doesn't do bad things to people, but God did give us the choice as to how we deal with it. He gave the terrorists the choice. They took it. I don't believe for a minute that this would fall under the purview of the Islamic religion saying that they're going to get 72 virgins to meet them when they go to heaven, because I don't think they went there. I don't think that the Muslim religion at all supports what those people did.
They had a big surprise.
We all have choice.
You live in New York then. You now live in San Francisco, about as far as you can get away from New York and still be in America. Why the move to California?
Well, I grew up in California. I grew up in Southern California. After 9/11, I contacted the school where I got Roselle, Guide Dogs for the Blind, and they, by January of 2002, decided to offer me a position to come and be a public spokesperson for the organization. The CEO was a visionary in that regard. So they offered a position. We had wanted to move back to California even before 9/11, and we had offered and tried to work with the company that I was working for at the time to make that happen. They didn't have an interest in doing that. And then when the job from Guide Dogs came along, it seemed like a kind of a dream job that I decided to accept, so we moved back to California. Was it in fear because of what happened? Absolutely not. But California has always been our home. We never thought we'd live in the Bay Area. On the other hand, now we have the right to say "Go Giants," you know, and that's a good thing.
Who are they?
yeah, the team that beat out the Yankees, who didn't even make it, or the Twins. I would point out.
Yeah,
but
thank you.
But
thank
the
you,
you know the thing is that it's still California. It's closer to home. It's more wheelchair accessible out here for Karen, who uses a wheelchair. Okay. You know, it's just been home, and so it was a chance to come back home. I worked for Guide Dogs for 6.5 years, and now I own my own company, doing exactly what I talked about, public speaking, helping to consult with companies about inclusiveness and diversity, and traveling just to try to inspire people.
When people hear your message, what is a typical response, if there is such a thing?
I will say that, and if people go to my website, www.michaelhingson.com, they'll read what some of the people have said who have heard me speak. You know, you could hear a pin drop.
Hmm.
People come up to me afterward and they say that it is inspiring, and they really have had their lives changed by what happened. And I've heard from any number of people afterward who have come along and said, your story has given us a completely different perspective, not only on what it means to be blind, but on life in general, and given us the power to realize that we have more control over our lives than we thought we did.
You give an analogy between the sheep that are afraid and how we respond to the Good Shepherd. What did you learn from your own father's experience tending sheep?
The difference between us and the sheep is that although we fear, we do have more of an ability to reason and overcome that fear, and maybe not totally make the fear go away, which I don't think that we should do, but rather to put fear and the uncertainty about the unknown in its proper place and use that to fuel us and use that to help us move forward when we need to, while at the same time looking at what else goes on around us and using our inner tools to be able to focus and do what needs to be done. And I think that my dad taught me that. My dad certainly stepped out when he and my mom also said, we're going to take this child home. We don't care that he's blind. He can do what he wants. My dad accepted a job in California when I was 5. They had never lived out in California. So my mom and dad moved to California to accept a job. I think there are a lot of times that my parents were certainly pioneers. I was told when I was 15 in my freshman year early in 1965 that I couldn't ride the school bus anymore because the superintendent decided that the Board of Education rule in the district that said no live animals on the school bus superseded state law that made it a felony to deny me access to any public conveyance or common carrier. My father, who knew nothing about the law, but had a lot of common sense, he was an electrical engineer. My father researched it in the library, fought the school board. The school board voted 3-2 to support the superintendent, but then my father had no fear about writing to the governor and said, look, this is wrong. It's in violation of the law. All we know is that I was back on the bus within a week or so, and that the superintendent had been summoned to Sacramento. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. But the reality is that my father took on the brute and won, and the reality is there is something to be said for right.
Yeah.
God set out laws for us to follow, and it's up to us to choose to follow them. And God has given us many principles to live by, and we need to do that if we want to truly be good children. And I think that the laws that God has given all of us, no matter what our religion, they're all pretty similar. And the fact of the matter is that we need to choose to follow them. Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to have more chaos, and that's just not a good thing.
It all comes down to choice and the choices.
It all comes down to choice. Yeah. But God gave us the ability to choose. God gave us free will. Catherine Marshall talks about it a lot in a number of her books, and you know, it's all about free will. And God can't take that free will away from us without making us something other than what he created.
My guest is Michael Hingson. He's the author of the book, Thunder Dog, A True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and The Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. It's published by Thomas Nelson. About a minute or so left, Michael. Many of us go through hardships and struggles and disappointments and loss. What would you say to those listening who feel the weight of their circumstances pulling them down?
And we're about to be in another situation where many people are going to go through hardship course, Hurricane Sandy. We don't necessarily control the actual circumstances that would cause the hardship, but we can choose how to deal with it. We can choose to motivate ourselves to move on. No matter how bad things get, there is a lot to be said for prayer. There's a lot to be said for using our inner tools. There's a lot to be said for the fact that we can motivate ourselves and we can work to get through it. We've got to be resourceful. We should always talk to others, whether it's through a prayer group, certainly talking with God, not to God, but also asking and not being afraid to ask other people for help and for wisdom. The fact is we all like to help each other, and all we need is to be asked.
For listeners who'd like to find out more about you and about your book and other things, is there a website?
www.michaelhingson, michaelhingson.com. Thunderdog is available in any bookstore and all through all the typical e-reader sites and so on. If they also would like to see Roselle, a very famous animal artist, Ron Burns, created a portrait that's available for sale, so they can go to www.ronburns.com/Roselle, R-O-S-E-L-L-E, and get that. Again, they can go there. But they can also get it through our website, www.michaelhingson.com.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
You have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. God bless.
Your home for the light. AM 850, WWJC, Duluth.